Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, I'm excited to have with us our guest, Lisa Van Dusen, who is the executive director of the Palo Alto Community Fund. Lisa, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Wonderful to be here, Stephen.
For sure. It's really a pleasure to do this. And part of what we're going to get into today that I'm really excited to share with our audience is to talk about scale. And I know your organization has had a lot of growth over the past handful of years. And so I'm excited for you to be able to share that out and, you know, talk about how you were able to grow the organization and also talk about, you know, what comes with that. What are those challenges, you know, operationally to manage that growth? And then also I want to get into a conversation with you around how you focus on grant making and trust-based philanthropy. So without further ado, would you mind just sharing a little bit of background, a brief kind of bio of yourself and how you came to become the executive director of the Palo Alto Community Fund?
Yes. I joined the Palo Alto Community Fund as executive director in July of 2020. And as we all can think back to that time, just under 2 years ago, you know, it was what turned out to be early COVID. And it was a time when there was a lot going on in the nonprofit world trying to provide support that was much needed and a lot of unknowns. I have lived in Palo Alto for a number of decades and have been a donor to the Palo Alto Community Fund for a long time, have played a number of different roles in the community and in the region in Silicon Valley. So I've been familiar with the organization for quite some time, and I began looking at the opportunity to join in this role before COVID started. And it was my belief has always been that there was a lot of potential with the Palo Alto Community Fund to do more of the great work it was already doing, but just to do it at greater scale and to meet more of the needs. Our mission is, I'll just share that, is really to channel to focus on the unique needs of our community and channel charitable giving of local donors to effective or nonprofit organizations that improve the quality of life for everyone in Palo Alto, East Palo Alto, and Menlo Park. That's all right in the heart of Silicon Valley, right next to Stanford University, and right at really what I think of as ground zero for income and perhaps more importantly, wealth inequality. So we have some of the, you know, we have a high concentration of billionaires in our community, and we have a high concentration of people that are living at completely unsustainable levels. And so that stark contrast is kind of closing that gap in ways that are lasting is really our mission. And so my background, I first landed in on the peninsula here in Silicon Valley to win the cable television franchise for a subscriber-owned cooperative, cable co-op of Palo Alto. And it served the same basic area, East Palo Alto, Palo Alto, Menlo Park, Stanford, and surrounding areas. So the idea was to convince the city council to give this different ownership structure an opportunity to own what we thought would be an important utility. At this point, there was no data on broadband. It was just sort of plain vanilla cable. And that's what was going on around. And we had a different vision that it would be both technologically new and we would have a different ownership structure and keep those profits and the kind of control with the consumers. So we ended up getting the franchise, partnering with Pacific Bell to build the system, and we rolled that out. So I had some experience with concept to, you know, very much a physical plant that we then ultimately sold for, you know, many millions of dollars and ended up with endowing a media center here in our community, which still is going on. So after that, I joined the local newspaper, which at that point was one edition once a week, the Palo Alto Weekly, Embarcadero Media. And fast forward a few years, I was in charge of not just the revenue, but also later all the innovation of new publications. And one of those things was starting our online presence in, we launched in 1994, which turned out to be the first newspaper to have all its contents on the web in the world. And, you know, it was classic Silicon Valley story of somebody, you know, reaching out to me from a garage in Palo Alto saying, I can do this. And I was like, tell me more. And we did it and bootstrapped it. And again, it was a scale situation where we were, you know, I was always competing with the print editors to say, why can't we break, what is it going to take for us to break this story online? And remember, just like, give me a number, you know? And so very fun opportunity to partner with entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley who needed eyeballs and, you know, connecting with the community. So it's always been a sort of a creation of community platforms throughout my career. And after that, I did a string of things working in sustainability and energy at Stanford. I restarted Leadership Palo Alto with a colleague. So civic leadership development, worked on some other sustainability and climate projects. And then I went to Silicon Valley Social Venture Fund, known as SV2, which is a community throughout Silicon Valley that helps people become more effective givers, more effective philanthropists. And, you know, different ages, different stages, different dollar resources available to them, but usually a pretty hands-on approach. And so there was a lot of learning. And I feel like that really set me up to understand what's possible, not just to have the tool of grant making and donations, but also advocacy and impact investing and connecting with people in communities in a more kind of level, you know, reducing the power dynamic between funders and nonprofit organizations trying to raise those funds. So I had the opportunity to just, you know, really roll out those innovations one by one in collaboration with others and trying things that hadn't been done. So there's been a through line in my work of community, of collaboration, of innovation. Innovation feels like a tired word, but really trying things that hadn't been done. And, you know, back to the cable company, we were one of the very first to put data on broadband. We had that in our garage as a test. So, you know, just trying things where we're combining technology, people, ownership structures, business models that are different. And so when I was, you know, asked to consider this opportunity in the spring of 2020, it just felt like it was a perfect chance to try to really double down on continuity of place. Because one thing I've experienced is things take time and you don't get to know a community overnight, and you collaboration can take longer, but can be, you know, more meaningful in the end. No one is, these challenges we're trying to address are not going to be solved by one funder, one organization. It's really sort of a puzzle that's being put together, an ecosystem. And so to do that in my own community, and as I said in the beginning, I'd felt like there was opportunity to take something that had been around for, you know, over 40 years and had done, you know, built a really strong foundation and strong relationships in the community, but that there was a much greater need and an opportunity to try to meet that need by growing the resources and then the resources being deployed to organizations. So it seemed like I was going to be in a fishbowl because I can't hide around here having lived and worked in this community for so long. But I really felt like it was a fantastic opportunity. So
I appreciate all that. You know, a question that I'm curious about, and I sort of prefaced, is you talked a lot about, you know, your interest in innovation. Can you talk to us about how that's carried over to how the Palo Alto Community Fund, you know, yourself, I'm sure your board and your employees think about innovation in the nonprofit sector, especially when it comes to grant making? You know, one of the things that we chatted about kind of off the air was this notion of trust-based philanthropy. And I know that, you know, you'd recently shared with me that most recently this spring you had distributed 96 grants. It was about $1.7 million. So how has the Palo Alto Community Fund approached grant making?
Just to give a little context back to this sort of question of growth, I may get my numbers slightly off, but in 2019, in the spring, I think we made grants of on the order of $450,000, something like that, to maybe 40 something organizations. In 2019, in June, our board signed off on a strategic plan that basically was committing to trust-based philanthropy, to instead of the dollars that were raised each year going into our endowment, because we have an endowment, that the default would be that it would go out the door in pass-through grants to nonprofit organizations in our community. And if someone wanted to specify, could go to the endowment, they could. And to have a deeper connection and knowledge and kind of exchange with our community, you know, organizations, other leaders, just sort of really connecting with what's going on, and that we would invest in ourselves as an organization, which I think is really significant. So those were some of the basic tenets of the strategic plan, and we have been living that out. In fact, our board chair likes to say it's like we blew through our goals, you know, in the first year. It was a three-year plan because COVID hit, you know, less than a year later. So we went from in 2019, you know, and it had been going up slightly, you know, that sort of 450,000. When we started doing pass-through grants, we did 731,000. So we didn't double, but, you know, significant increase because our donors wanted their donations to get, you know, into action right away. We still have some people who contribute to the endowment. And then we, the next year, you know, in the spring of 2020, really like minutes after the shutdown happened here in California and here in Santa Clara County, our board said, we've got to do something. We are going to regret it. And I, at this point, was talking to them, but was not in this role. And to the credit of the former executive director and the board, they said, let's do something. They started a COVID relief fund, COVID-19 relief fund, and raised more than $1 million, you know, in a matter of, you know, less than 8 weeks, and got it out the door to organizations with no application, just the utmost trust-based philanthropy in action, you know, like what's needed. And because there were those existing relationships, they knew who to give it to and who could get it out the door. So you asked about innovation. We are not structured to get funding to families directly. So we had to know how could we do that. This group formed that worked with the school district. You don't think of Palo Alto as having a need of having families who might not have the resources. You know, they can't, they're frontline workers. They didn't have income. How a lot of times, you know, people on the free and reduced lunch, it's almost 10% of our school district. They're getting food at school and they weren't getting that. So a lot of really immediate needs for families. And so I don't have to go into the details, but through a lot of just knowing the right people and kicking to action, we were able to get gift cards out, you know, to families and other forms of support that they needed right away. And because we had switched to general operating support, the money that they've just gotten and that we were giving out again, some organizations said, wait, is this a mistake? We just got a check from you. And we were giving them another one. They were able to use it for whatever they needed. A lot were deploying food to people that didn't have it, or, you know, sometimes housing. So a lot, childcare support, all kinds of different very basic immediate needs in that context. So I would say that that the COVID impetus was a huge kind of turbocharge for us. It gave us visibility. It tested us to say, okay, we want to be innovative and we want to be responsive and we want to scale. Okay. And to embrace the trust-based philanthropy of just giving unrestricted money and making it simpler for organizations to get the money. We did that in, you know, to the nth degree in that moment. There was the opposite of bureaucracy.
Right.
So that was really exciting. And I think it taught the board. And again, meanwhile, all during this, I'm having conversations about, am I going to join this organization? I'm thinking about my own vision for the organization. And one of the things that they also started in that spring were something called the Dave Mitchell Impact Grants. And they were intended to be larger. Our largest grants have been $20,000. So something more than that. And then also to have a greater impact and to be aligned with the values of this particular leader, who in whose memory it was named. I really felt like there was a lot of opportunity there. I've now had two rounds of that. The first year was $75,000 combined to two organizations. Last year, we did three organizations. One was barrier-free vaccine equity, you know, to really deal with what we saw happening of, you know, 82% of people in Palo Alto and Atherton and so on were vaccinated in early April. And in the communities on the other side of 101, the highway, less affluent, it was the flip. It was 28%. So we wanted to fill the gap of support for the clinic that was, you know, they had the vaccines, they had Facebook giving them space or food or maybe shuttle service, but they didn't have the money to get the doctors and the staffing, which was absolutely mission critical, and to do it in a way where it was, you know, there were no language barriers, there were no transportation barriers, you know, everything was, you know, just to be as friction free as possible. So that was one. Youth mental health was another one, where we've been seeing, and it's only rising, you know, something like 75% of youth self-describe as having you know, serious mental health challenges of one sort or another. And so we funded two organizations, one, a new arts organization that was providing art therapy for youth, like, you know, age 6 to 12, and which is a different approach to mental health, but one that that community wanted. And then another organization, Children's Health Council, which was working on creating, again, barrier-free services in the same community, meeting in driveways and working with parents and kids. And then the third one was, again, I would say an innovative approach, United Hope Builders, which is a nonprofit that's partnered with a B corporation, a for-profit B corporation called IndieDwell, based in Idaho. And they're building a factory, the nonprofit is, United Hope Builders, in East Palo Alto, where there's profit sharing for employees, they're quality jobs, they're building modular housing, and they're working with non-traditional landowners to put that housing, which could be one or, you know, like Legos put together, and creating either, you know, a social impact for a church that wants to use an empty parking lot, or a car dealership that needs housing for its employees to put on top of the dealership. So a lot of innovation. Again, I would say this is a through line for what I believe makes sense, is don't have it do one thing. Have these grants and the working with organizations that are working on multiple issues all at one time. So it's housing, it's employment, it's that closing that income inequality and wealth inequality gap. It's creating partnerships. It's creating revenue share or other, you know, really hacking the whole like land cost problem and using underutilized assets. So, and being a model for others to say, you can do this. So that's who we funded last year for the impact grants. And this year we went from last year, $150,000 to $400,000. And again, it was a bold move by our board to say, let's take of our $1.7 million that we're granting, we did $400,000 in those impact grants, $1 million in our regular annual grants, many of which go to some tiny organizations that are doing great work, you know, very much in their communities. And then the third thing was to do multi-year grants, which is one of the top tenets of trust-based philanthropy, is not having this sense of running for Congress every year and always raising money. So it's been an exciting year to be able to do those things. And I can share more about our impact grants this year, but again, it's like, how do we make change that is truly game-changing and transformational and systems changing, not just kind of helping an organization do more laps around the hamster wheel? You know, it's like the feeding versus teaching to fish kind of mindset. So anyway, I'm very excited about not just the, you know, the increase in dollars that we've been able to do, but how we're doing it, and also the creativity and you know, and transformative nature of who we're funding and what they're doing.
That's awesome. I really am so inspired to hear everything that you just shared. And I love your perspective and willingness to fund innovative things, because a lot of people are funders, right? Grant-making organizations or individuals are scared a lot of times of innovation. Obviously, you're coming from a very innovative place of the country. So it sort of seems like, you know, it makes sense to be doing this geographically where you are, doing it anyway, but I can just kind of imagine the perspective and the leadership that's come out of that area of California, you know, over the past 5-6 decades now, and much more. I'm curious, can you talk to us, just as the organization's been growing, what are some of the operational or staffing changes or additions that you've been needed to make in order to, you know, get to this point where you're doing this type of grant making at this type of scale? You know, how is the operational side of the house changed?
That is a very relevant question. So when I was hired, I started and am still at 3/4 time. So I was the only employee. So 1 3/4 time, you know, 0.75 FTE. And within 6 weeks, I hired somebody on a contract basis to help with literally the, you know, the data input and the bank and the post office and, you know, just sort of a lot of that needed to happen week in, week out at a much higher volume and all year round, because our donations, and I can't say enough about how the community stepped up. We would not be able to do this, but for the generosity of many people in our community. So that was the first thing I did, and I had support to do that. And that was, I felt very fortunate. So we also have a very active working board, and our board has stepped up immensely. So 23 people on the board, and you know, most of them are really hardworking board members and in time, and they're all valuable in different ways, you know, providing a lot of support in different ways. So, but you know, they knew that wasn't going to be sustainable for them. The prior executive director worked, I think, 25 hours a week as opposed to supposedly 30 hours a week. And she certainly wasn't doing that during the COVID relief thing. So I think people knew that we needed to bring on more resources, but it took a year for me to hire somebody else as an operations director of operations, who started in July of 2021. And that was not one, you know, so we're in a fiscal year, July 1, June 30. So, you know, I waited about 2 weeks to get the person on board, and that has been, you know, huge. So I could not be happier with the, you know, my colleague, and I feel a great team and complementary to one another. And hopefully that the goal is to expand her time somewhat as well. And then we did that strategic plan that I described in July of or June of 2019. And we looked at the whole question of, you know, well, there was supposed to be a check-in late, like 6 to 9 months later, and COVID happened. And so we didn't do that. So this spring, we've been looking at like, what do we need infrastructure-wide? What systems, what resources, and all that kind of thing. So resources to expand awareness are a big one. We've gotten some grants from local funders for that, which has been fantastic. But we also need the people side. So we are working now on a project basis with a consulting firm named, I'll say their name, Spoke Consulting, that does great work in communications. And you couldn't hire one person to do all the things they do. They do, you know, web, graphic design, writing, events, PR, I mean, and just sort of strategic, you know, support. And they're very elastic and they only work with nonprofits. And so we're working with them on a project basis right now and just having a great experience and hope to bring them in a more ongoing way. So that's one way that we've expanded our, you know, just right now, our capacity. And I think.
Well, I want to comment on that or just get your perspective just to drill it in because, you know, there's obviously a massive labor shortage going on. And most recently had someone on the podcast, executive director out of state of Washington that leads Nancy Long, that leads 501 Commons. And they put out a whole like, you know, wage survey and just going over the challenges that nonprofits are having with staffing. But I think you bring up a really good point that there's ways to bring talent onto your team through, you know, outsourcing through different, you know, agencies or types of firms that can bring a lot of firepower, you know, in very specific engagements.
Yeah. So that's an example of how we're doing it. We're doing it for a couple, well, that's sort of the plan. Again, we haven't approved our budget for next year yet. We've got the finance, you know, it's in process. I'll just say that. So we don't know what the future is going to bring in terms of our revenue. I mean, this year ahead is going to be a challenge. There's a lot competing for mind share and wallet share. And, you know, it's an election year. There's a lot going on in the Supreme Court. That there's a lot of attention being paid to there, you know, the market's down. There are, you know, there are people I think have COVID fatigue, certainly in terms of like, that is not, the problems are not gone. The needs are not gone, but some of the attention to Ukraine, I mean, they're just conflicts at war. There's so many places that people's attention and money is going. So we're going to have to really work hard and creatively and smartly to not just maintain, but hopefully grow the revenue that we raise and the grants that we can give, because the need will be, you know, all the more, I'm confident.
Absolutely.
So,
with that, if you don't mind, I wanted to bring up something here on the podcast that I had in our notes, Lisa, which was this concept of the overhead myth. You know, basically how a lot of foundations will focus their giving on, you know, organizations that spend the least. And I know that's obviously, that's counter to, you know, a lot of what you shared kind of on the innovative side of how you all are finding great organizations that are doing innovative work that blends, you know, takes a lot of elements together, as you talked about, you know, employment, housing, and so on, combines all those efforts. But I'm curious, you know, for organizations that we work with that are those, you know, mission oriented boots on the ground organizations that, you know, are scattered across the country and obviously are looking for ways to attract and find funding. What might be your message to them? You know, because I think a lot of individuals that we work with that are running organizations are really tired because they don't and stressed out because they don't have innovative foundations like yours. So what would be your message to them? And what are ways you think that they maybe can get past this overhead myth when they're seeking fundraising from different foundations or individuals or corporations?
Well, I think I would say, first of all, if you look at the trust-based philanthropy practices, there, you know, it's multi-year funding. And it's unrestricted funding. And I would say the unrestricted piece is the most important, that I don't know what the number is now, but I've heard it's as high as 80% of funders are, and I think this is probably mostly institutional, but also probably some individual, especially from DAFs, donor advised funds, that literally just saying, here is money. We trust you as an organization to know how it is best deployed. And if that is to pay your staff people, then that is what you should do, is if it is to keep your lights on or whatever you need. And I think if we can't take the lesson from COVID, you know, as an example of that, if you'd gotten money for a program that was taking place, let's just say it was an after-school program and it had to be in person and it had to be this and that, those things were not happening, but something else very important needed to happen. So we fundamentally are choosing, you know, who we are betting on as an organization and trusting them to do what they need. And that's what we want. That's what we want people to do with us. And very often, you know, the thing that needs to be, that the resources that are needed are the staffing. That's the asset that the organization has. And, you know, so it's just backwards. It's so backwards to say, oh, how little can we pay you? You know, it's just, you know, we're trying to help people thrive, and yet we are starving, you know, this sort of nonprofit starvation cycle. I didn't make that term up. So I would say to funders, give nonprofits unrestricted funding. And if you don't trust them with that, then maybe they're not a good fit for you. And get to know them, have conversations, ask that they be honest with you about what's needed and why. And I think there's an element of sort of, I don't know, something about people needing to know that they're responsible for, you know, this program or that. It's like, it's feels too vague to people, but it's like, that is really, really what's needed. And I think some funders are starting to change, and it's really encouraging, but many, I had a conversation just this week with somebody where, you know, there's some people in that foundation that really that's their goal, but usually those costs are somewhere, and it's either coming out of the, really like literally the sleep of the nonprofit leader, or someone else is paying for it and you're just not seeing it. It's like, there's a nonprofit workshop that where it leads up with, you know, if you have a product, you know, there's, what is the cost of goods sold? And you just have to look at it like that. And so anyway, okay. I just think people need to move into the, you know, to this century.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. So.
Yeah, absolutely. No, really well put. I really appreciate that. Lisa, I'm curious if there's any, I know you just published this report detailing the grant making that you've completed this spring. For individuals that are listening that are interested in getting involved with your efforts, how can people get involved? Are there any other upcoming initiatives or events, you know, this summer or fall that you'd like to share out about Palo Alto Community Fund?
Well, we can do what we do because people donate to us. And we've had more and more people in our area who have chosen to give to us in large amounts, in some cases, rather than give directly to organizations, or very often in addition, because we are excited to be able to provide, you know, this portfolio of organizations that most donors would not be able to know what's going on or discover. We kind of like to think of ourselves as framing issues, finding organizations, funding them, and then fusing this notion of kind of getting people together. So we do a lot of connecting. Even the any organization that doesn't get a grant from us through our annual grant cycle, which opens in December and we close the applications, which we have streamlined a lot, by the way. That's another piece of just a simple application and also simple reporting. But we have conversations and we learn so much from that. And we are able to, you know, just be able to provide, again, that support, but we are able to provide connections. You know, there's social capital, maybe one organization meeting another, introducing to another funder, thinking about collaborations. How can we, I think of it all as a puzzle. And again, back to these Dave Mitchell Impact Grants, we are able, so many organizations told us that they don't, back to this, the workforce challenges, mental health providers. So we're funding an organization that does the most training of mental health professionals in our counties, anywhere. We're funding them. We are funding, there's an organization that goes between the tiny organizations that deliver food and the big food bank, but there's an organization that provides hot meals and prepared meals that they get from companies and then deliver it out via food truck and other things. So it's like, we have these little pieces of the supply chain that are missing, and we're able to support some of those missing links. So that, I guess what I'm saying is, I'm so excited that through simply listening and connecting with these organizations and broadly having 130 conversations and more, you know, over periods of months, we are absorbing kind of, oh, this is where the needs are. So
I think
we're having an event in early June outside, and we, you know, our donors and our grantees are coming to that. We'll be doing it at one of our grantee organizations, the Peralta Junior Museum and Zoo, and we'll be having one of our grantees, Ada's Cafe, do the catering. So social supply chain for an event, and then we'll be doing more to help people learn about what's going on. More social media, people can follow us. Maybe you can put those in your show notes.
Absolutely.
And just follow us. We want ideas. We want to know what's going on, and we want to help, you know, help the broader field. Really, you know, we're learning, and like, there's a small climate collaborative, you know, how can people work together on the ground to help and be a model for places elsewhere in the country and the world.
It's great. I really appreciate you sharing all that. And I think a common thread that really came out of what you just most recently shared, which is a good way to end this episode. You know, this was very much about trust-based philanthropy in the sense of, you know, your model at your organization in terms of dollars that you're giving out to the grantees. But I also think there's a notion of sort of the value that your organization brings to funders of trusting in your organization to, you know, be that matchmaker, be the expert, understand, you know, all the organizations that are out there, and ultimately donate their money to the Palo Alto Community Fund so that entrusting you to be able to grant that out effectively. So I think that it's really wonderful what you're doing, and it's really good perspective for organizations that are listening to this podcast. And I can only hope that there's more and more of this trust-based philanthropy going on, so we can just have a much more efficient nonprofit world, and obviously therefore, you know, much, much better communities all around. So thank you so much for being a guest, Lisa.
Thank you. Wonderful conversation.
Well, we're going to end it there. For everyone that's been listening along, thank you again for being a listener at the Charity Charge podcast. Look forward to our next episode. Until then, take care.